From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we get a proximate look at some of the things going on in and around Washington, D.C. with Garland Nixon, who's a journalist in the Washington, D.C. and Baltimore area. We discuss two topics that are very hot right now in Washington, that being first, the meaning, if any, of the election this past Tuesday, and the other being the disclosures of a rigged primary by none other than Donna Brazile. Garland, by the way, is a member of the board of the ACLU, the national board of the ACLU. He's a journalist. He has a live stream that he does on Facebook. And what other venues? I've seen you on Fox, for example.
Yeah, I've done a number of things. So for many, for years now, I've been doing fairly regularly, some months more than others, but appearances on Fox, Fox News, Fox Business News, Fox Online. I do a radio show on Pacifica, a radio show on Sputnik News here in D.C. So I'm all over. I do podcasts. I mean, you might find me anywhere on the media on a given day.
Yeah, right. And I found you at the conventions, as a matter of fact. That's where we met.
Yes, yeah, that was I was covering the convention for Pacifica. I had a wonderful time doing that, not just for PFW but for the whole network. And that was a major learning experience for me, the DNC convention.
Sure. Oh yeah, for sure. So let's talk about some of the hot stuff in DC right now. We've got, first of all, the election. You had the gubernatorial elections in both New Jersey and Virginia that some people are holding out as being some bellwether of Trump's popularity. Not many people mention the fact that you had a Democratic governor in Virginia. You still have, actually, until the next one is sworn in. Terry McAuliffe, who is the former head of the DNC. And in New Jersey, that it's been a 2 or 3 year public relations disaster for the governor, Chris Christie, over Bridgegate. And the person that ran is his lieutenant governor, and so she's been identified with that, and that was a pretty close race anyway.
Yeah, there's a couple of things you could discuss there, not the least of which being this. In Virginia, if you talk about Virginia, I covered that race, and I met with very frequently with the person who was running the Get Out the Vote program for the Democrats. What I was told by her was that what that was a referendum on in Virginia was Charlottesville, that the Charlottesville issue scared the bejesus out of a lot of people of color, that there was a huge backlash against the GOP, who was seen as supporting the Confederacy, basically embracing the Confederacy, particularly, the GOP candidate, right, who had made statements in the past specifically about embracing the Confederacy.
Yeah.
So that was an easy one. So, there were local factors involved there regarding him. And, if you look at the midterm elections, and this can be considered somewhat of a midterm election, oftentimes midterm elections are older and whiter. That's the way they put them. Less people of color, less young people. But because of the Charlottesville issue, they turned out a lot of people of color. They had somewhere around 10% higher turnout than last time. And so I think that's what turned the tables on the GOP in Virginia. The other part of the thing to keep in mind is this. When you start talking about your local elections, your statewide elections, they're totally different dynamics. If you talk about federal elections now, the two big issues that you think about are number one would be, your Wall Street elitist kind of economic policies. And number two, foreign policy, the hawkish neocon former foreign policy. Right. And those are the two policies that were the most upsetting to the Democratic base, that tend to, kind of back away from the Democratic leadership. Well, right, when you talk about your local politics, in Virginia, New Jersey, those issues didn't come up.
Right. Yeah. We're talking in the national elections, neoliberal economics and neocon foreign policy. New Jersey, not to my knowledge, doesn't have its own foreign policy, nor does it have its own economic policy, really, other than the one that they all commonly have, because the last 82 billion governors in New Jersey have come out of Goldman Sachs or whatever. So to the extent they have an economic policy, there's some continuity there across administrations.
And let's not forget, additionally, what happened. Well, in New Jersey, we're also talking about both Virginia and New Jersey that have become, you know, New Jersey for quite a while, but Virginia, as of recently, they're solidly blue states. You know, right. So the fact of the matter is, the Democrats should hold, especially in an off, you know, in a midterm election year or close to a midterm election year, the Democratic Party should definitely hold serve in the solidly blue states. Additionally, as you said, in New Jersey, you're looking at a couple of factors, not the least of which being Chris Christie was one of the most unpopular governors in the nation. And add this, even though the guy who ran was a Goldman Sachs guy, he ran to the left. He ran hard to the left. He ran legalization of marijuana. You know, he ran $15 minimum wage. So even that, you know, I think there are a lot of progressives that are looking for. What they're looking for is for the Democratic Party to run towards them, not away from them. Right. If you look at the general election in 2016 with a Hillary Clinton and a Tim Kaine, they ran away from their base. They wouldn't embrace the $15 minimum wage. Right. They wouldn't embrace marijuana legalization. They wouldn't embrace anything the progressives wanted.
Right.
So at least this guy ran towards the base. And people like me have always argued the way you win is running towards the base. Give people what they want, and they'll come to the polls.
That's right.
And I think that showed, that demonstrated that in New Jersey.
You know, after the election, as a matter of fact, you know, when he was both his acceptance speech and then the media appearances that he did, he kept hammering on the $15 minimum wage. So it appears that whatever else he does, they intend to go there. And that is something that people have been organizing for a very long time.
Right. It's a matter of, to when you run towards your base, people will over. The bottom line is, I always put it like this in politics. Everybody in America is listening to the same radio station, WIIFM. What's in it for me? And if you want progressives to come to the polls, you have to tell them what's in it for them. And he said, this is what's in it for you. And they said, okay, we'll come vote for you.
That's
now, the fact of the matter is, he could turn and stab them in the back. But at least they have a chance to get what they want by having someone that'll at least mouth the words. Now they'll see, now that they put him in office, they'll get to see whether or not he's going to stand for what he said he was standing for. But I think a lot of people like me have argued that people will come to the polls. They will show up. But you got to tell them, you have to tell them, you know, this is what I'm going to give you, and it has to be populist policies that are attractive to the working class and the working poor and the poor and to millennials. Because he also talked about having the need to do something to address extremely high cost of college.
So that's New Jersey. In Virginia, you mentioned that you had, first of all, a response, a backlash against the Charlottesville thing and the, you know, rhetorical embrace of white supremacy that was made by a number of Republicans. Was there any similar movement by the Democratic candidates towards a progressive agenda, or did they feel that just riding the, the back of that particular reaction was sufficient so they didn't have to go there?
Well, unfortunately, you didn't get a progressive move from Ralph Northam, who was the Democratic president. I mean, the Democratic nominee who won by 9 points. You didn't. He actually, you know, unfortunately went in the wrong direction. He said some things that were very unpleasant to progressives, such as that he would sign a bill that would ban sanctuary cities. And he made other statements about, about Confederate monuments that he thought the town should decide. But what he did, what happened here too, the dynamic too, there's a little different because, you know, when I was growing up, I used to hear this in the black community, and that they said, basically, I'd heard people say, black people either vote for the Democrat or against the Republican. And, and now that is changing with the millennials, the black millennials, they ain't playing that game no more. They'll stay home first. Right.
That's what happened.
But with the older people, I think what you had in Virginia was people who voted against the Republican. They didn't vote for Ralph Northam. He could have beat him worse if he'd have ran, you know, more to the left. But he didn't. He won. I put it like this. He didn't win. Gillespie lost. So I don't think a Republican was going to win. Now you look at the numbers. I don't think a Republican was going to win there. You probably could have ran a bag of French fries and beat a Republican because of the response to, you're talking about a southern state where people have a very, very significant and horrifying memory of what happened during the Civil Rights Movement and before.
Well, the Capitol.
A bunch of Klansmen marching around, buddy. They ain't going to... They're not going to be happy.
Yeah, I mean, the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, was in Virginia. So, you know, it's there's a battle that's been going on there since the beginning of the U.S. Another question I have on that, you know, one of the things is, again, this is some kind of referendum on Trump and or Bannon. The reference to Bannon being due to the fact that he is putting together, you know, rumored to be and says he is putting together a insurgency campaign, particularly for Republican senators that are up for re-election next year. You have a third of the Senate up every 2 years. Next year, out of that, I think there's a total of 33. You have 8 Republicans, and the balance are Democrats, with the exception of 2 independents, being Sanders and the senator from Maine. You know, Bannon so far has... you know, I've been celebrating because the interim elections for senator, the primaries, he's won them and won them pretty big against most predictions. His presence really wasn't noted in this gubernatorial election, and he wrote a kind of scathing piece at the end about the Republican candidate, saying you can't phone in your campaign, basically. Trump also was not very visible in this, and so I'm wondering if he can really look at this as some sort of a measurement of their, you know, what's going to happen next year.
I don't think so. You know, when you look at Bannon, you know, one of the things that he takes credit for is Roy Moore winning. Well, Roy Moore was up by 8 to 10 points before Bannon even came to town, before Bannon or Trump or anyone else came to town. And he won by, 8 or 10 points, something like that. Yeah. So the bottom line is, you know, Casey Stengel used to say, the art of being a genius is taking credit for all the home runs somebody else hit. Bannon came to Alabama. He saw Roy Moore was going to win, and he said, "Hey, I'm behind Roy Moore. Roy Moore won, and then Bannon said, "Hey, I made him win." No, he didn't make him win. Moore had that. You know, that was an easy game to play.
Right.
What Bannon represents is he does represent some real problems, and so does Roy Moore, that the Republican Party has, and that's that they've got a, you know, their nutcase far right wing, you know, element that they have to deal with. And that's a large element in their party that they have to deal with. I bet you 25-30% or more of their party supports those kind of people, at least 25. But Bannon isn't, I mean, you know, he's going to cause them problems, but I don't see him causing a problem for you know, anyone else. He's going to take a lot of credit for things that would have happened with or without him. But, you know, he's not, by any, what we've seen is this: he's no tactician or strategist. I mean, just last night, I believe, or the night before, he was on Hannity saying Mitch McConnell should resign. That, you know, in order to make everything better, Mitch McConnell should resign. Well, what kind of strategy is that? I mean, you know what I mean? For him to do that, of what benefit? What does he get out of it? So, you know, Bannon is a fire breather. He's a flamethrower. But ultimately, I think he's a political suicide bomber, where, you know, he's going to take the party out and, you know, with crazy candidates and you know, I don't think he's a positive factor for their party, in that he ain't going to help them. In fact, in recent days, he actually volunteered to come to Virginia and do a rally for the guy Ed Gillespie, and Gillespie was like, "No, thank you. That's all I need."
Wow.
You know, is you coming up here with more white supremacists and scaring the black folks to the polls.
Let's shift gears a little bit. The Hold On in Brazil thing. What's the fallout like in the D.C. area? I mean, you're looking at it up
so
close.
So here's what you have. It's pretty pathetic, really, to me. It's a sad state of affairs, because what you're looking at is Donna Brazil. And I have to be honest and open here. I know Donna Brazil. I've been to her home. You know, I've talked with her before, and, you know, and I like Donna Brazil. I was very angry at her for what she did when, as far as giving Hillary Clinton, you know, slipping her the test questions. But if you ever met her and sat around and talked to her, you'd like her, because she's a very nice person. Right. And so, that, to be honest, I wasn't shocked either when she came out and just said, "Look, here's the deal." Because of all the people up in that circle, the ones that I've been around and know, I don't have a lot of respect for them. But she's one that I do have a lot of respect for, so I wasn't shocked. Now, a lot of people will say, "Well, she's just writing a book, you know, and they will, you know, they will certainly say, well, she's up to no good. And I don't, you know, think much of her still. And I understand that because there are a lot of people that are mad at her. But if you look at what she did, it was pretty courageous because I mean, she's on the outside looking in now. All the people that were around her, she was on the inside. She's some of the things that she said were, I mean, absolutely damning.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. Not for nothing. Some of the other people that have come out and you know, shown some of the backroom dealings around the Clintons have, you know, like Ron Brown and others have met some ugly finales. So well, it does take a little courage.
Sometimes, you know, one of the safest things that you can do in this world is be on, you know, let out everything you know.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Think about this. If it's the mafia and you know something, and you haven't told, I can make sure you don't tell.
Right, that's right. But if you
but
tell it
all.
Once
you get it out there, it gets a little too obvious.
Yep, that's right.
You know, and the fact of the matter is, what I think is telling, what is really telling, is the reaction. You know, they've been blasting her. Now, what's interesting is, they've been blasting her in non-substantive ways.
Right.
Like, well, you know, Tom Perez saying, well, you know, the word rigged is a little... is a loaded word. Well, we're not talking about semantics here.
Right.
That's like me robbing the bank and somebody saying, you robbed the bank. Well, the word robbed is a loaded word.
Right.
How about we just say that I, you know, made an unscheduled withdrawal. It doesn't matter whether you call it a bank robbery.
You took the money. So you can net it out, right?
Yeah, they're playing these semantics games, right. Everything in the world, because that's who they are. They're never going to say they're sorry. They're never going to say we did wrong, because that's who they are. These people are corrupt to the core. They don't care, and they're living a fat, happy life. They're getting money. If you look at one of the things that she said, one of the things she said was, normally it costs about $2 million a month, but under Debbie Wasserman Schultz for the last 5 years, it's been $4 million a month. She had one of Barack Obama's consultants for $180,000 a year. She had Hillary Rosen. Hillary Rosen is like the biggest Clinton apologist in the world. She's always running around. Clinton's wonderful. Well, we thought, okay, she's just a Clinton. Love it. Well, we find that she runs this political consultant company. She was on payroll for $25,000 a month.
Right.
So we see that these Clinton hangers-on, some of them that we just thought, oh, they're just Clinton lovers. Well, no, that wasn't it.
Right.
They're getting lining their pockets.
Right. They're getting paid. Well, you know, the same thing that we saw with the so-called hack of the DNC, and that we've seen from a number of other leaks from, you know, a whole bunch of leakers. Rather than addressing the substance of the disclosure, what they do is attack the, you know, either impute a motive or attack the motive of the person that leaked it. And so there's no discussion of the behavior that is being exposed, but rather of the person exposing it.
Right, right. Because they do pretty much, you know, they play the hand they're dealt. The bottom line is, you know what they say in court, you know, if the facts are against you, what is it? If the evidence is against you, argue the facts.
Right.
If the facts are against you, argue the evidence.
Right,
if the evidence and the facts are against you, scream and beat on the table.
Right, that's it.
That's what they're doing. They're screaming to be. What are they going to do when they are absolutely outed? They are lying. Robbie Mook is out there saying, "Oh no, it wasn't rigged."
Right.
That, you know,
right.
No, it wasn't rigged.
Right.
So now that all the evidence is out, you said that's the other. That's the easiest one, and that is just flat out denial.
Yeah.
There's a great book by Patricia Evans called The Verbally Abusive Relationship, and they talk about things that abusive people do, and one of the things they say is denial, where it's like somebody hits you in the head, and you say, ow, why'd you hit me in the head? And they say, I didn't hit you.
Right.
You know, they curse at you and call you your name, and you say, hey, why'd you call me that name? And they say, I didn't call you a name.
Right.
Just flat out denial, it didn't happen, and that's part of what they're doing. Part of it is they don't care, and they feel like, what difference does it make? We make the rules. And we make the rules committee. The other part of it is, what other option do they have to simply come out and say, we did it? Let me give you a perfect example, I think. If you look at WikiLeaks, right, when it comes to the WikiLeaks emails, here's what they say. Ignore the content of the emails. You should be concerned about where they came from. Well, where they allege they came from, right?
They
allege they came from the Russians, and they say, ignore the content.
Right.
You should be concerned about where these emails came from, who was behind them, right?
Right.
Now, when we find out that the Clinton team financed the Steele dossier, right? Financed this dossier. When we find out that the Clinton team paid for some guy to supposedly go to Moscow and get it, right?
That's right.
So now they're colluding with the Russians by their language.
Right.
And people say, hey, wait a minute. You paid for this stuff to come from the Russians. You know what they say?
Right.
Don't worry about where it came from.
Right. Look
Let's
at this
only focus on the content.
Right, exactly.
Well, wait a minute. When it comes to WikiLeaks,
right.
we should ignore the content and focus on where it came from.
That's exactly
when it comes
right.
to the Steele dossier, we should ignore where it came from and focus on the content. Their arguments are ad hoc. Whatever argument they need at the time to work for them,
that's
the one they're going to use.
Yep, I know. Yeah, and they're contradictory. Both of them are out in the public sphere at the same time. I mean, they're practically side by side in the media, and yet the people reporting it don't even draw, you know, any kind of a tie between the two things. And it's naked in front of them.
Well, the other thing you got to keep in mind is what happened to the WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks showed us that people in the media were writing stories
right.
and sending them to the to the Clinton people before they even
right.
published them.
Right, that's right.
Let them
tweak it.
The media was complicit, so the media has to play down the WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
They have to attack Assange. They have to go along with the Russian thing, with the Russian bullcrap. Why? Because they're complicit. They're not defending the Clintons. They're defending themselves. It's all one. You know what's interesting? So at first we found out that the Clintons, and we found out that the Clinton campaign and the DNC was all one, no delineation. But if you look at WikiLeaks, what you realize is if you go from the Clinton campaign to the DNC to the mainstream media, there was no delineate. Those were the right. same people.
Right. And actually, something that's even more scary to me, and that, you know, we had a full reading of the law of this back in the 1970s, when you have the DNC paying for people to go collude with some Russians and come up with a report that is then handed to the FBI, who then talks about and actually does help fund further development of this, and then use it as a basis for FISA warrants to spy on the other party through a White House, who sits on top of this, that's endorsing the candidate that generated it in the first place. A White House, by the way, that was publicly and privately assuring European governments, among others, and who knows who else, that there was no way that Trump was going to be elected president. As an aggregation, that's a pretty scary construct.
It really is. And so now the fact of the matter, you know, you and I, I'm sure neither one are no fan of Trump. But what we are right. a fan of is democracy.
Right.
What we are a fan of is a fair democratic government. And it's fairly obvious we have no parts of that right now. Right now, if you ask me, it seems to me that we have a deep state that's still controlled by the Clinton people. No, let me change this. Because when we say Hillary Clinton,
yeah.
Hillary Clinton is an avatar for something else.
That's right.
She's
right.
an
That's
avatar
right.
for the gold for right. the Goldman Sachs people. She's an avatar for the military industrial
she's,
and Wall Street
She's
people.
Personnel. She's furniture for the same operation that the rest of it is. This whole deep state thing. She's like an adjunct to it, or an employee, or whatever. Not it ain't her deep state. It's Clinton.
Right. People are like, well, they paid her for those speeches, or they're giving her money to do things. That's not the way it works. They weren't giving Hillary Clinton money to do things in any more than the New England Patriots are giving Tom Brady money every time he throws a pass.
Right.
They're paying him because he's on their team.
Right.
They're paying him because he's wearing their uniform, because he's trying to win the game for them.
Right.
So when they gave her money, it wasn't for a speech or for this or that. When they paid her, it was because she was their quarterback.
Right.
They handed her the ball and said, throw it, and she was throwing it.
Right. That's exactly right.
And so, you know, people are mistaken when they think Hillary Clinton is the be-all and end-all of these people. They're looking at some Kamala Harris's. They're looking at Cory Booker's. They're looking around saying, okay, Hillary Clinton didn't work. But you know what? I'm sure we can find somebody that will get the job done.
Yeah, for sure.
And in D.C., so my office is on K Street. Let me tell you, dude, up and down K Street, what you've got is you've got, and here's the other thing that people don't know. You've got these think tanks, right? The Atlantic Council. Go to the Atlantic Council webpage, .org.com, whatever it is, and click on their funders. The Atlantic Council is funded by Lockheed Martin, by Chevron, by Pfizer, by Northrop Grumman. Listen to this. The Atlantic Council is funded by the United States Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, U.S. State Department, the United Arab Emirates. I mean, on and on and on, right? So the most powerful military, by NATO, this is the Atlantic Council. You go to the Washington Post, and every time you turn around, they're saying the Atlantic Council research research fund found out this. They don't tell you who the Atlantic Council is. I walk another block down the street, and there's the New America Foundation. You know who they're funded by? Eric and Wendy Schmidt. They have the Eric and Wendy Schmidt senior fellowships. You know who Eric and Wendy Schmidt? They own Google.
Right.
You go from one of these. What people don't do, and I'll advise anybody listening to do, when you start reading these stories, you'll find that, well, the blah, 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 and this came from the such-and-such foundation, right, the such-and-such fund. There's one called ICIJ. When you see these organizations, think tanks, et cetera, click on them. Go look at them. Go look at their sponsors. Go look at who's on the boards of directors. Yeah. And you'll find they're all the same people.
Yeah, I mean, take a look at the Atlantic Council alone. You've got Henry Kissinger, Victoria Nuland, Philip Breedlove, David Petraeus, Pickering, a whole lot of these people. They're on
here's
the board of directors.
Here's a name. That a lot of people don't know that's on the Atlantic Council, on a senior fellow of the Atlantic Council. Dmitry Alperov. You know who Dmitry Alperov is? He's the guy that owns CrowdStrike. The only organization who's ever looked at the DNC computers, Dmitry Alperov owns that organization,
right,
and he's on the board of directors, or either that or he's a senior fellow, whatever. He's one of the people that runs the Atlantic Council. It's a joke.
So, you know, you have this incestuous set of, relationships in Washington that people have been talking about for many years. This is the so-called swamp that Trump was talking about. How do you think he's doing in the battle against the swamp so far?
No, it's a joke. Well, you know, here's and see what happened with Trump. He comes in. Trump thought the president's the guy in charge because he's used to being a CEO. Well, God knows, you and I, I'm sure, agree with virtually no policies of Donald Trump. But Donald Trump came in there. What's the first thing that happens? Everything that he said, every word out of his mouth was leaked into the newspaper. And they ended up getting what? General Kelly. They ended up surrounding him by generals, deep state operatives. You know what I mean? The General Kelly, General this guy, General that guy. See, what everybody hears is CIA, they hear NSA, they hear FBI, right? But what they don't realize is there is a gigantic monster of a very, very powerful deep state entity called military intelligence.
Right.
And people never see, that's the one that doesn't exist, military intelligence, and it's powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
It is powerful, and the president can say, I'm going to do this, and the military intelligence will say, oh, let's go bomb something that will block it. Let's go do something that makes that not feasible.
Right. And we saw some of that, I think, in Syria and, a couple of hits that were taken, basically, that thwarted Trump. And the whole, not for nothing, again, the whole Russiagate thing has thwarted one of the policies he promised to bring. How could he possibly try to make a better relationship with Russia in the present climate here?
They ain't going to let it happen. People need to understand Ukraine. There is a great movie I would advise everybody to see. It's called Ukraine on Fire. If you want to understand Ukraine, watch it. I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. And in fact, I know for a fact that you can go to YouTube and watch it, called Ukraine on Fire. It is when Paul Manafort got caught up, got in trouble for what happened in Ukraine. And they found out that Tony Podesta, the brother of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, got in trouble for the company that he started with Hillary Clinton's campaign manager for shady dealings in Ukraine. I immediately knew that was coming. Because Ukraine is the most corrupt, one of the most corrupt countries in the world.
Yep, it's true. All right, Garland, thank you very much. A pleasure as always. And tell us about places we can find your work.
Well, I'm at Garland Nixon. That's at Garland Nixon on Twitter, Garland.Nixon on Instagram, and just plain old Garland, GARLAND, Garland Nixon on Facebook, and pretty much everything I do, I put up there.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure.
Same. Thanks. Bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.